Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
What Palestinians really think about Hamas, an opinion poll taken just before the war, revealed some interesting data.
The vast majority said they didn't have trust or a great deal of trust for Hamas.
Will a rising death toll in Gaza change their opinions? I'm Marco Werman. Also today, in Ukraine, the counteroffensive against the Russian military is far from over.
So very, very early in the offensive, the Ukrainians got out of their vehicles for the most part and started to advance on foot, tree line by tree line. They're making progress, but it's very, very slow going and quite costly.
And in Zimbabwe, there's a tradition of stone sculpture. For the artists, it's a livelihood with meaning.
They also do it to depict what they are, that we are a people of our own. We have a culture of our own. We have customs of our own.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. Let's remember that while global attention has turned to the war in the Middle East, there are also raging battles in Ukraine. In Russia, their military carried out an exercise yesterday that included a simulated nuclear attack. That sound released by the Russian Defense Ministry. The drill took place hours after the upper house of Russia's parliament agreed to revoke the country's ratification of a global nuclear test ban. Meantime, in eastern Ukraine, Russian and Ukrainian forces continue to battle for control of territory. The Ukrainian military is making slow and steady progress with the counteroffensive that began in the summer. To get an update on the situation with that conflict, we're joined by Dmitry Alperovich. He's the chairman of the Silverado Policy Accelerator, a think tank in Washington. What is your reaction, Dmitry, to this nuclear counterattack simulation yesterday by Russia? What should we take away from this exactly?
This is actually an annual exercise that the Russians have conducted for years that simulates a nuclear response to a strike on Russia that uses intercontinental ballistic missiles, bombers, and submarine-launched missiles, and Putin coordinates that. It actually took place the same week as a NATO exercise, Steadfast Noon, that took place in Italy, also simulating a nuclear response.
So, Dmitry, turning to the fighting in Ukraine, what is your assessment of Ukraine's progress in retaking territory held by Russia?
Well, it's certainly been a steady grind since the offensive was launched in early June by the Ukrainian forces. They've made progress, but the challenge that they've had, the primary challenge, is that they've mostly been advancing on foot. And this is a massive territory that is just not going to enable them to break out without using armored vehicles. And the challenge with using vehicles had been, of course, the minefields, the deep fortifications that the Russians had built, the use of attack helicopters. So very, very early in the offensive, the Ukrainians got out of their vehicles for the most part and started to advance on foot. They're making progress, but it's very, very slow going and quite costly.
Staying on the front lines, we've seen a lot of fierce fighting around the city of Avdiivka. Some eyewitnesses say there's nothing left there. Everything is destroyed. What is the situation there, and does it tell us anything more about Ukraine's abilities to retake territory?
The reason that why the Russians care so much about this town is that it's very close to the town of Donetsk, a major territory that they occupied in 2014. And the Ukrainians have been able to use that town to launch artillery strikes against Russian forces in that town. So they want to drive the Ukrainians out of it. They've launched major offensives against Avdiivka just in the last 2 weeks. They've lost over 100 different vehicles, lots of troops. So it's been a very, very costly assault. The Ukrainians have held that territory, but the situation is getting quite precarious for them.
There have also been a number of drone strikes by Russia and questions about Ukraine's ability to defend against them. We've been reporting on Ukraine's own homegrown drone factories, very DIY, but also pretty effective. But does Ukraine need better defenses when it comes to Russian drone attacks?
So they've been getting air defenses, obviously the Patriot missiles that are used to intercept ballistic missiles that the Russians have been launching against Ukrainian infrastructure. They've been using German and short-range air defenses to help shoot down some of these drones. They absolutely need more because obviously it's a huge country, second largest country in Europe. There are lots of cities and infrastructure to protect. And the Russians are determined, I think, to repeat what they tried to do last year, which is to take down the Ukrainian energy grid. They just conducted an attack against a nuclear power plant using these drones in Ukraine. They want to shut down electricity going into a cold winter to try to make life very miserable for the Ukrainian public.
Where do you see the battle in Ukraine's eastern regions going in the next few months, Dmitry? Like, what are the Ukrainians trying to achieve in the medium term? And has that changed very much in recent months?
It really hasn't since June. The strategy still remains the same, to try to get to the Sea of Azov, to cut off Russian ground lines of communications and prevent the resupply of Crimea through this so-called land corridor that the Russians have occupied since 2022. The Ukrainians know that it's going to be slow going. They appreciate that the initial plan that they had in early June to advance quickly has not worked because of the extensive fortifications that the Russians have built. So they're switching to plan B, which is the slow grind, but they're committed to continuing it through the winter. I don't think the weather is going to deter them. It's going to make things more miserable, but they're going to keep going.
Dmitry Alperovich is the chairman of the Silverado Policy Accelerator, a Washington, D.C. think tank. Thank you very much for the latest, Dmitry. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Between February and May of last year, Russia's military laid siege to the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. By the time Russia claimed victory there, Mariupol was destroyed. One Ukrainian family that got out is now settled in Ashland, Oregon. Jefferson Public Radio's Roman Battaglia was with them on the one-year anniversary of their arrival in the U.S.
Everything changed for Elena and Misha Zhivotovsky on February 24, 2022, when Russia began an all-out assault on the southeastern port city of Mariupol, where they lived. Elena was getting ready to take her two kids to school that day.
And they, I got a message for the teachers, but this, don't worry, everything will be good, just maybe for safe, stay at home.
Olena and Misha say they could hear bombs falling all around them.
Terrible sounds. It was 24 hours a day. And we lived there, we stayed there 24 days. And we lived there without light, without internet, without water.
Husband Misha says he saw Russian soldiers kill children and the elderly in the streets. The couple says they were lucky to survive in a city reported to be almost completely destroyed from bombing. Misha bought an old Soviet-era car to pack his family into.
We just took important things. It's document for one important things what we took, and it was my stuff for hairdressing. I don't know why. It's for me, it was very important.
Hairstyling was one of Olena's many jobs in Mariupol. She brings in a gray and green messenger bag filled with various scissors, clippers, combs, and even the cape you wear when getting a haircut. She says she still cuts her family's hair and offers her services for free to friends. The Zhivotovskys left Mariupol, bound for Misha's aunt's home in Narubaika in central Ukraine. What would usually take them less than a day's travel stretched out over three. Misha says they were stopped at countless checkpoints by Russian soldiers, interrogating them and looking for tattoos that could link him to the Ukrainian military.
I take my clothes out and check tattoo, and one post. Take automats to my children and ask children about how my name, how her name.
They spent 3 months in Narubaika before going to Germany. Ultimately, they decided coming to America was the best option for their kids. When they first arrived in Ashland a little over a year ago, they knew very little English. Olena says volunteers would come to their home every day with food, but the language barrier was difficult.
For me, I 1 month, I just, I not speak, I just yes, no, it's all. And now just a little bit better, but I need to work.
Olena's kids were learning English in school back in Ukraine and have already made lots of friends.
Do you ever think about going back to Ukraine, like when the war is over?
I don't know. We want to stay, but I want maybe come back to see my family.
We don't think a lot of about this because we don't know how this war finished.
Olena's mother and sister are still living in Mariupol, and Misha has family that's been living in the Russian-occupied Donetsk region since 2014. Olena tells me the instability of their home in Mariupol further cements the idea of staying here permanently.
There's a possibility it could all happen again.
Yes, I'm very afraid to because it's happened twice, and it can be happened again.
Of course, he never stopped.
The program Olena and Misha came to the U.S. under allows them to stay for one more year. Olena says they're looking at applying for temporary protected status to extend their stay further. She says she couldn't imagine this happening to her just a few years ago. The couple say being able to live safely together as a family is what they're most grateful for now. For The World, I'm Roman Battaglia in Ashland, Oregon.
Turning now to the Middle East, last night Israeli troops launched a limited raid into Gaza in what the military says was preparation for a larger ground invasion. This week has seen some of the deadliest days in Gaza since the start of the fighting almost 3 weeks ago. An effort at the UN Security Council yesterday to send more humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip failed. That was after the U.S. and Russia vetoed each other's proposals. The World's Diri Biskaran takes a look at the communication breakdown at the United Nations.
This week in Gaza has been brutal. Apartment buildings flattened in airstrikes. Hospitals are turning away injured patients as supplies and fuel run out. In this video, Al Jazeera bureau chief Wael Al-Dadu kneels over the body of his teenage son, who was killed in a blast at a refugee camp in central Gaza. They're taking revenge by killing our children, he says. His wife, daughter, and infant grandson were also killed. It's far from the businesslike calm of the UN Security Council on Tuesday, when the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres repeated his call for a humanitarian ceasefire.
Protecting civilians does not mean ordering more than 1 million people to evacuate to the south, where there is no shelter, no food, no water, no medicine, and no fuel, and then continuing to bomb the south itself.
In a six-minute speech, Guterres condemned both the Hamas attacks and the continued Israeli bombardment of Gaza. But it was this line that grabbed the attention of the Israeli delegation.
It is important to also recognize the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. The Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation.
After the meeting, Israel's ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, told reporters these comments were out of line.
When you say that these heinous attacks did not happen in a vacuum, you are tolerating terrorism. And by tolerating terrorism, you are justifying terrorism.
The Israeli ambassador demanded that Guterres immediately resign. Israel's foreign minister canceled an appointment to meet with Guterres, and Israel later said the country would refuse visas to UN officials.
Hamas beheaded babies, burned families, raped women, abducted kids, babies, Holocaust survivors. And the SG is blaming the victim? You are blaming Israel?
The next day, Guterres said his comments had been misrepresented. Gershom Gorenberg, an American-Israeli writer and historian based in Jerusalem, says to understand the intensity of the Israeli official's response, it's important to take a step back.
When somebody has just undergone a really terrible, brutal attack, coming to them and saying, well, there was a context to this, this is how you contributed to it, is probably not going to be thought of as a sympathetic or appropriate remark.
Gorenberg says he doesn't consider Guterres' comments or the Israeli response to be good diplomacy.
Is there a context? Yeah. But on the other hand, none of that context justifies murdering 1,000 civilians.
Hussein Abish, a senior resident scholar for the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, says that the context does matter.
That you can understand Hamas's brutality and the fact that it went on a killing spree in southern Israel without noting that the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem has been going on since 1967 without end.
Members of Israel's right-wing government openly advocate annexing the occupied West Bank and displacing more Palestinians. Ibish says that in these past weeks, Israel is acting with no regard for civilian casualties. Meanwhile,
Hamas demonizes Jews and Israelis, so there is a kind of grotesque equivalency here.
Ibish says that in this conflict, the rhetoric of both the Israeli government and Hamas devalue and dehumanize civilian lives, and this rationalizes the murder and brutality that follows.
It's a way of taking away the humanity of the targeted population so that they may be killed, expelled, bombed, kidnapped, brutalized, or in some other way abused, and it either doesn't matter or it's okay because.
For the violence to stop, people have to start by seeing each other as human, he says. For The World, I'm Derry Bouscarin.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. President Biden says he wants the United States to compete with China, but he added, I'm not looking for conflict. Those comments came from the president yesterday. Now Biden has a chance to meet face-to-face with China's top diplomat. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi begins a long-awaited visit to Washington today. Both sides have shown some willingness to lower the temperature in this tense relationship, or at least make a fresh start on a few issues where the two rivals might cooperate. To learn more, we reached out to Yun Sun. She directs the China program at the Stimson Center. Yun Sun, why is this visit to the U.S. by China's foreign minister so significant?
The high-level diplomatic engagement between U.S. and China had been suspended for quite a while. In fact, the last time a Chinese foreign minister visited Washington, it was 2018. With the COVID and with the deterioration of the bilateral relations, we really need the top-level diplomatic engagement and communication for the two countries to sit down and talk about their differences and disagreements. Second reason is significant is that Wang Yi's trip to Washington clearly is aimed at laying the ground for Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit of San Francisco next month, tagged along the APEC summit to be hosted in San Francisco.
Yeah, and yet China has been kind of reluctant to confirm that San Francisco meeting. Why is that?
One, they want to keep the suspense. They want to keep U.S. on its toes. The second reason is because you might remember back in February, right before Secretary of State Blinken was going to visit China, there was that balloon incident.
Yeah, the concern over the white spy balloons.
Yes, the spy balloons from China flying over the state of Montana and across the United States.
Mm.
So it was a black swan event, but it pretty much set back the engagement process between U.S. and China for about 4 months. So I think the Chinese want to, one, play it safe. Two, they want to keep the leverage over the United States.
Interesting. So what does Foreign Minister Wang Yi hope to walk away with after his Washington meetings with President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken?
I think he's aiming for paving a solid ground for Xi Jinping's visit. So on the top of the list, there should be no embarrassment of Xi. If you recall, President Biden has called Xi a thug, a dictator. So I think Wang Yi will want to make sure that in terms of diplomatic protocol, President Xi will be treated with the utmost respect from the U.S. government and Biden administration. Two, I think he wants to lay the groundwork in the sense of potential issues that U.S. and China could agree upon and maybe make joint statement. And let me be bold here, even joint actions. So that would include, for example, the Gaza crisis that hopefully will include conversations and deliverables, hopefully, on the issue of the Ukraine war. And I know that they're going to talk about South China Sea and China's unsafe or provoked behavior against the Philippines in the South China Sea. And last but not least, I think on the top of the U.S. list, there's the issue of fentanyl.
Yeah, I mean, in that fentanyl area, there is kind of generally the ever-present concern over trade between the two countries. Just one kind of issue on trade, there's concern from China that the U.S. Should kind of ease up on exports like semiconductors to China. But the U.S. is concerned that semiconductors could be used in Chinese weapon systems. So how does the White House begin to even square that circle if it doesn't want more tension?
I think currently the semiconductor chips issue, the two sides have a mutual understanding that the U.S. will continue its restriction. And no matter how the Chinese squeak, they're not going to force, or they will not be able to force Washington to move its calibration on this particular issue. But honestly, I think for the Chinese, since they're aiming for Xi Jinping to have a glorious visit of the United States in November, they're not going to let semiconductor chips to ruin the trip.
Mm. Yun Sun directs the China program at the Stimson Center. She's been speaking with us about the start of a Washington visit from China's top diplomat, Wang Yi. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
Ever since October 7th, social media has faced a surge of disinformation around the Israel-Hamas war, and platform managers are still scrambling to control it. Nearly 3 weeks into the conflict, how are they doing? Not so good, as KQED Silicon Valley reporter Rachel Miro found out.
Perhaps you've come across photos and videos of the war that turn out to be recycled from another conflict, or video game clips. UC Berkeley professor Hani Farid specializes in detecting manipulated media and deepfakes.
How do you believe anything anymore?
Farid adds, when the photos and videos of the war are real, they get drowned out by partisans intentionally sowing doubt about them. The most recent dramatic example was the bombing of the hospital in Gaza, which appears, after extensive outside analysis, not to have been committed by Israel, but an errant rocket fired by Palestinian militants. But early evidence posted on social media was met with fierce blowback.
It's not just that there are fraudulent pieces of information out there. It's that when the authentic pieces come out, we don't know if we should trust it. And that makes reasoning about what is happening really, really difficult.
In an age when many people have stopped looking to get their news from news organizations, experts like Farid say social media platforms are failing to prioritize truth over engagement.
Yeah, let's start with Twitter. I refuse to call it X. They just get a big fat F.
The platform formerly known as Twitter used to be influential, especially among journalists. Since Elon Musk bought it, however, academics and researchers say X has become an amplifier for even more loosely moderated platforms like Telegram, where grisly footage reaches hundreds of thousands of people eager to consume unfiltered propaganda directly from extremist groups.
It is clear that Twitter has become more of a hellhole than it was pre-Musk, and it continues to decline.
But X has never been as big as Meta or Google or TikTok, and these companies aren't making the honor roll either in terms of content moderation.
Nobody gets an A or a B. Nobody's doing a good job.
Take Meta, for instance. Callum Hood with the Center for Countering Digital Hate gives the owner of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp something just north of F.
If I know that one of the most popular posts on Facebook, which, you know, is according to data that I know they have access to as well, is footage of an execution with no warnings on it at all, I have very serious concerns about what they're doing.
Reached for comment, Meta pointed to a blog post announcing its Special Operations Center, staffed in part with fluent Hebrew and Arabic speakers, quote, working around the clock to monitor our platforms while protecting people's ability to use our apps to shed light on important developments. But Hood says, don't take Meta's word for it.
The truth is, I don't think any organization out there has a very good grip on how disinformation or hate is spreading on Facebook or Instagram right now, because every possible tool that we once had for investigating it, they're unusable.
A similar lack of transparency makes it impossible for researchers to independently assess the efforts of TikTok, which self-reports that it's launched its own command center. Farid and many, many others say these recent efforts are ineffective because they're overlaid on top of a business model designed to keep users on the platforms watching ads.
People should be angry that when they go online, they are being manipulated by state-sponsored actors and by the very platforms, and we are no longer informed citizens. We're not arguing about how to do something or if we should do something. We're arguing about 1 + 1 = 2.
And that, he says, kills our ability to have a rational, constructive conversation about anything, let alone a war. For The World, I'm Rachel Miro.
When the Taliban took over Afghanistan, this young woman had to make a quick decision, stay with her family or get on a plane to the United States.
I was seeing my future under the Taliban regime government.
And that was no future for her. Today she's a graduate student in Washington, D.C. Her story, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Nearly 3 weeks ago, Hamas unleashed an unprecedented attack on Israel. Since then, Israel has been relentlessly bombing the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian territory that Hamas controls. But do the Palestinians who live in Gaza actually support the militant group Hamas? This is a question our next guest was researching just before that October 7th attack. Amani Jamal is co-founder of Arab Barometer. It's a nonpartisan research group that analyzes attitudes of citizens all over the Arab world. She says their latest survey shows that before October 7th, Gaza residents had serious doubts about Hamas.
The survey showed that on the eve of the Hamas attack on Israel, support for Hamas was on the decline. Hamas received minority support from among the Palestinian population. The vast majority said they didn't have trust or a great deal of trust for Hamas. We found that there was a lot of negative scrutiny of the Hamas government in terms of its mismanagement and corruption. We also found that Gazans still, by and large, support democracy. About 40% of Gazans basically don't believe that Palestinian leadership will represent their interests moving forward. And the majority of Palestinians would not vote for Hamas if elections were held today.
Your survey group in Gaza was almost 400 people, just shy of that. How representative was that group, given that the population of Gaza is more than 2 million?
Our sample is extremely representative of the Palestinian population of Gaza. Everyone from women, educated, non-educated, the younger cohorts from 18 to 29, older cohorts, 30 and above. We have Hamas supporters, we have Fatah supporters, we have nonpartisans, we have unemployed individuals, we have those who are employed, we have those who believe the economic situation is extremely dire and those who do not. So it's pretty representative.
Can you talk a bit about the generational differences in terms of which Gazans supported Hamas and which did not?
What we found is that among the younger cohort, the cohort that's 18 to 29, there's slightly more support for Hamas, but that support never goes above a third, even among that younger cohort.
So the ideology of Hamas is committed to the destruction of Israel. What did your survey find in terms of support for that?
Well, when we gave people the option of what do you think is the most viable solution moving forward among the options of a two-state solution, a confederation, or a one-state solution that includes both Palestinians and Israelis in the one state or other, the vast majority of Gazans said they favored a two-state solution, a peaceful two-state solution where Palestinians and Israelis can stand side by side.
If that is a desire, does it surprise you that a group that is cut from the same cloth as the Muslim Brotherhood, Destruction of Israel, Hamas, was even elected in the first place by Palestinians?
Well, it does surprise me and it doesn't, right? If you look at 2006, most analysts will tell you that its sort of doctrine to destroy Israel was not a salient electoral platform that they ran on. They ran on the platform of justice and weeding out corruption in the Palestinian Authority. Let's just assume that maybe there were a majority of people, which we've never seen in our data, that are committed to Hamas's doctrine to destroy Israel. That was in 2006. That was almost 20 years ago. You've had new generations of Palestinians born since then. Entire new population almost replaced itself, and people are still talking about the 2006 elections.
How do you expect the views you heard could have changed since October 7th?
I think if we were able to get into Gaza, at least what we're hearing anecdotally, people are shocked about what Hamas did to innocent Israelis. This is sort of what people are saying is sort of like a new low for these terrorist tactics. It's just really horrific. What we also know, though, unfortunately, Marco, is that when there is this excessive bombing, almost indiscriminate bombing of Gaza that leads to multiple civilian casualties and deaths, including women and children, this bodes well for winning more support for Hamas. So these cycles of violence work in Hamas's favor.
And do you think the desire by Gazans today, post October 7th, for a two-state solution remains what they want for the future?
100%. I mean, by and large, our surveys have shown in the Arab Barometer across the board that the vast majority of Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza have and still are committed to a two-state solution. It's the political process that has failed Palestinians.
Finally, Amani, what concerns you most about a likely ground invasion by Israel into Gaza?
The humanitarian devastation. We still don't have humanitarian corridors that are secure. We still don't have humanitarian zones that are secure. The United Nations is calling for immediate assistance in the way of water, food, medical supplies. We haven't seen any of that come through. Even U.S. senators are calling for, some of the U.S. senators are calling for additional support. There can be just a humanitarian catastrophe. You have about 2.5 million Gazans in that territory, and a ground invasion is going to only make the situation all the more dire. The other big question is, will it succeed in eradicating Hamas? What we know is that after every such incursion or at least military response to Hamas, Hamas has only grown stronger in strength after such an event. So you end up with thousands of Palestinian deaths, Hamas stays in power, and then there's no movement towards a two-state solution.
Amani Jamal is co-founder and principal investigator at Arab Barometer, a nonpartisan research group that conducted a survey just before October 7th about Gazan attitudes toward their rulers, Hamas. She's also a professor at Princeton University. Amani, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The Taliban have freed a well-known activist in Afghanistan. Matiallah Wassaw had been campaigning for women's and girls' education. He was arrested 7 months ago and accused of being a foreign agent. Wassaw spent years traveling to remote areas of the country, speaking with tribal elders about the importance of education. A little over a year ago, the world's Shirin Jafari connected with Matiallah Wassaw.
This is our fight, he said, and the consequences are clear. Wassaw told me that he was well aware he might be beaten up or taken to prison, but he said he's willing to accept that if it means a better future for the next generation of Afghans.
After the Taliban banned school for girls beyond the sixth grade, many women knew that staying in Afghanistan was not an option. Those Afghan women who could got out. Universities around the world accepted some, but the transition to a new school in a new country, often arriving on their own, has not been easy for those who did leave. Reporter Rebecca Rossman recently spoke with one young woman from Afghanistan studying in Washington, D.C., who finds that life in the U.S. comes with all kinds of instability.
The leaves have officially changed color, and a crisp, cool air has blanketed the Georgetown campus as hundreds of students make their way into the brick building lecture halls at the 5 p.m. bell. Hoodies and sweats are the norm here, which is perhaps why 29-year-old graduate student Nassim sticks out with her formal attire. Long black dress pants and a black and white freckled blouse. She's asked me to only give her first name over fears for her family's safety at home.
The education system of Afghanistan is totally different with the education system in the U.S.
And it's beyond how students dress. Here you have things like office hours, the figure skating club, and homework.
You don't have homework in Afghanistan?
No.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, Nassim's hometown of Herat, a city in western Afghanistan, was invaded by the Taliban. At the time, she was working with a local ministry to increase the number of women-owned businesses. She went outside onto the street in order to see the Taliban.
I returned back to home and I cried. I was not able to imagine what will happen in the future about my work, my study, and also in the society participation.
Several weeks after that, Nassim was offered a lifeline. An aid group found her a spot on a U.S. military plane that was evacuating people to Washington, D.C. But she was told she would have to leave her family behind and only had minutes to make a decision.
From one side, I was seeing my family. From the other side, I was seeing my future under the Taliban regime government.
She got on the plane. Nassim eventually settled in a suburb of D.C., where she worked as a cashier in a grocery store, applying for grad school on the side. Last year, she received a scholarship to study at Georgetown. When we met, she had just started her second year of studies in global human development. She has her own apartment in the city, and she's made a few friends. But it's her first time being truly on her own, and it's lonely.
In Afghanistan, I had not the experience to live independently. It is hard, but also from the other side, it will be also good. Because when I experience some difficulties, I can build myself to be strong, to be brave.
Nassim shows me photos of the family she had to leave behind, her parents, 4 siblings, and 9 nieces and nephews.
They are my nieces, 12 and 8.
Eating ice cream.
They speak on the phone every day. She worries about their safety constantly, especially her nieces. The Taliban has banned girls over the age of 10 from attending school. There's also the little things she missed, like the food. She tells me about a craving she's had for this one dish called landi pilau, a rice pilaf.
The landi pilau is one type of rice.
She says she'll have to wait to go home until she can have the real thing. But visiting Afghanistan is complicated for a number of reasons. The big one being that, like most of the 90,000 Afghans who have arrived in the U.S. since mid-2021, she doesn't have an official residency, meaning she can't leave the country. Rather, she's on a temporary status called humanitarian parole. Last month, the Biden administration extended protection for another 18 months. Once it expires, she could lose everything. She's depressed.
Because always I think what will happen about my uncivil life here.
Nasim is living between two worlds of uncertainty, one being the situation for women and girls back home, and the other one tied to her immigration status here in the U.S. She worries about what happens if she loses the right to remain here, because going home is no longer an option. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Washington.
Zimbabwe has a tradition of talented sculptors who work in stone. Their work can be found in museums, gardens, and in the homes of art lovers all over the world. You can find a permanent collection of life-size figures lining a block-long concourse in Atlanta's International Airport. Zimbabwe sculptors once made good money. That was until political and economic turmoil started to keep Western buyers away. Despite the lean years, many of the artists have not given up. Ish Mafundikwa met some of them in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Sculptor Leo Berekai is using a hammer and chisel to carve a grey piece of rock at Chapungu Sculpture Park. It's a sprawling open-air gallery on the outskirts of Harare. Here, some artists do all the sculpting and polishing, even the massive 10-foot pieces, all by hand with just simple tools.
The stone is spring stone, and when I finish it, it's going to be black in color after I rasp and sandpaper it.
The 18-inch figure is beginning to take shape, a woman relaxing after taking a bath. Some of the sculptures in the park weigh several tons, figures of mothers wrapped around their children, arms and hands reach out of black stone, huge expressive eyes peering out of rock. This is a tradition that goes way back. The word Zimbabwe itself means big house of stone. Stone sculptures were found at Great Zimbabwe, the ancient city built of stone several centuries ago. The remains of the complex, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, are still standing. Roy Guthrie, the founder and director of Chapungu Sculpture Park, says the artists don't just sculpt to make money.
They also do it to depict what they are and depict that we are a people of our own. We have a culture of our own. We have customs of our own.
The artists used to make good money selling to tourists and buyers who resold the pieces in their galleries abroad. In the year 2000, the Zimbabwean government launched the sometimes violent takeover of white farms, ostensibly for the resettlement of landless blacks. That, according to Berekai, was the turning point.
The bad publicity in Europe, in America, made tourists shy away from Zimbabwe. The messages they were getting over there, they would think there is a different race. You could not walk in the streets.
Roy Guthrie's wife, Edith Mushore, also director at Chapungu, says while more than a dozen artists used to create pieces at the gallery, several have given up.
One artist is making sausages, another artist is growing fruit trees, another artist is now a cattle rancher, and other artists are just making do, maybe going back to the rural home and living off the land, subsistence farming. That's the reality.
Letwin Mugavazi, who has been sculpting for more than 30 years, is one of a few female sculptors in Zimbabwe. She has exhibited and sold pieces abroad. Mugavazi works in a shed in a yard in Chitungwiza, a low-income neighborhood outside Harare. Her most expensive piece fetched $15,000. However, she says some of the few who buy to resell in their countries are taking advantage of the lack of buyers. One of them sold a piece by Letwin for $27,000.
I had sold it for $650, but sometimes you have no option when you know that if I get this $600, it's going to food on the table for my children.
But supporting her family is only part of the story. While there is an abundance of stones suitable for sculpting across Zimbabwe, sculptors have to travel to buy them from landowners and transport them to wherever it is they work. This costs money.
Last week I went to my home village where we get stones. I wanted to bring them to Harare, but the money was not enough. It's so expensive nowadays to ferry stones from where we get them.
Farai Muchemwa, the Deputy Director and Curator of Contemporary Art at the National Gallery of Zimbabwe, encourages stone sculptors not to give up. She believes instead of waiting for foreign buyers, they should target the local market. Muchemwa dismisses the notion that locals do not appreciate art by saying the commercialization of stone sculpting targeted foreign markets.
There's an opportunity to appeal to a local audience by making work that is relatable and priced within the range of local buyers.
Instead of carving to appeal to international buyers and pandering to Western tastes, she is interested to see if this generation can produce art that reflects more traditional influences. For the world, I am Ish Mafundikwa in Harare.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Psychedelic rock in Cambodia. It thrived there in the 60s, but was then deemed corrupt and too Western by the communist leaders in the 70s. The band Dengue Fever, based in L.A., has spent the past 20 years putting their own spin on classic Cambodian psychedelic rock. Their latest album just came out last month. It's called Ting Mong. Today on Movement, our series about music and migration, Maclete Hadera speaks to the lead singer for Dengue Fever. Chom Nimol reflects on her own personal journey from a refugee camp on the Cambodian border to concert stages all over the world.
How did you learn to sing?
My brother, I remember that when I was young, he was know how to play guitar, but I don't want to be a singer at the time. Mm. I'm not sure I'm going to tell you the truth. My dream was to want to be an actress.
Oh, wow.
And then my family laughing me. And my brother said, no, we don't have a blood for the actress, but we have a blood for singing.
Mm.
My brother told me, my bigger sister, she is a famous singer.
Oh, wow.
And at that time, she lived in Cambodia. We separate after Khmer Rouge.
Mm. The Khmer Rouge ruled and terrorized Cambodia in the late 1970s. During the civil war that followed, Nimol and most of her family escaped to a refugee camp just across the border in Thailand. But her oldest sister, a singer, stayed behind. And as a child, Nimol encountered her in a very unusual way.
She's famous singing on the radio, and then my mom heard her on the radio, and then she said, oh, that's my daughter. She's still alive. And I was so young, I thought my sister inside the radio.
Oh.
Yeah, I said, oh. And then I remember that my mom and my brothers, they told me about your sister have very good voice. She's the best singer. She's the sweetest voice in the whole world.
Hmm.
Her voice is superpower.
So how did you go back to Cambodia?
The world will end.
Mm-hmm.
Civil war will end. So UNHCR bring us from Rabiji to Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that my sister, she's alive in Cambodia. So come back. I'm here waiting for you guys.
And then you were reunited.
Yeah.
But then how did you go from not wanting to be a singer to becoming a famous singer?
My sister moved to Canada for a couple years, and my family is very down, so I need to make some money to support my family. My brother, he's very serious. You have to become a singer. You need to learn how to sing so we can make money to support our family. So Cambodia at that time, 1997, they start the first Cambodian, like, it's similar of American Idols.
Nimol auditioned, and she got on the show.
And my biggest sister, who is famous already, and she tell me, if you are loose, her name is going to be down, right? She said that.
That's so much pressure.
It's true. But she told me, I know you can do it. I learned every single song and I cannot sleep about a week. I pray. Wow. I'm singing, I'm depressed. The first day on TV, super nervous.
I bet. Because you were 17 or something, like you were still young. So
I remember that start 16 and a half, not 17 yet. Wow. 1997, yeah. Skinny and super innocent look. Just come up on stage, so nervous.
But you did it.
Yeah, I did it. The best female singer and first live on TV.
And so how did your sister react when you won?
She said, that's my sister.
She was proud.
Proud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After winning that competition, Nimol got invited to perform in the U.S. She toured around singing at Lunar New Year's celebrations. Then she picked up a regular gig in Long Beach, and that's where she met the members of Dengue Fever. Ting Mong is their sixth album together. Is there a song on the record that feels that it's like the most special for you, either musically or with the lyrics?
Yes. I remember that we were in Cambodia when we have a concert. Mm-hmm. Went to the Stinky Market to buy some brohok and the dry fish.
The Stinky Market? Back,
I mean, called Stinky, yeah, Stinky Market. It's very stinky fish and all the bird stuff.
Uh-huh.
But that's how we eat. Have you been? You've been to CMW, you need to go to the market.
Oh, I'll go.
You can smell it from far away.
The band's guitar player, Zach Holtzman, started writing a song about a particularly stinky fish paste.
A brohok is a mud fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's very popular of my community.
Mm.
My people, everybody eat brohok. They cannot live without brohok. So he wrote the music and I'm writing the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a song about, I know it is brohok is stinky, but tastes very good. If you never eat it, you should try it. You should try it. If you don't try, you don't know. If you are falling in love with me, you should try the stinky mud fish.
There's wisdom in that, you know?
Yeah, stink.
But delicious.
But it's delicious.
That's Chom Nimol of the band Dengue Fever. For more stories of the crossroads of music and migration, search for the podcast Movement with Macleet Hadero. The series is produced by Macleet and Ian Koss and supported by the National Geographic Society and the Mellon Foundation. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Kathy Chan, Carrie and Nelson Hoffman, Sanford Waxer, and the Fire Rose Fund of the Roots and Wings Foundation. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.